we're going to do is we have a number of work session, House bills are set up for work session. We also will be having a public hearing today on Senate Bill 446. Because we've already heard the House bills, I'm going to go ahead and see if we can't take care of the work sessions on those. That way, for those individuals that are here only for that, they can go ahead and take care of other duties, maybe actually have some sunshine before the next thunder and storm comes through. So with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2740. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2740A clarifies the responsibilities of motor vehicle brokers and details disclosure requirements. It prohibits a broker from receiving fees from both the buyer and the seller. We heard this on May 12th, and it has no revenue impact and has minimal fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Ready to get rid of this thing?
Yes, sir.
Move House Bill 2740A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2740A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? No, ordered. And I'll carry this one. And we'll close the work session on 2740A. And we'll open a work session on 2718.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2718 allows a public utility with assets of more than $500 million to obtain excess workers' compensation insurance coverage from a surplus lines insurer. Has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We heard it on May 12th.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Move House Bill 2718 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2718 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And does anyone like to Senator Beyer will be our carrier. We'll close the work session on 2718 and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2294.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2294 makes acceptance or denial of the new or omitted and injured worker medical condition claims the responsibility of the insurer or self-insured employer with appeal to the Workers' Compensation Board. This has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We heard this on May 12th.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2294 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2294 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Ringo, would you be kind enough to carry this one?
Sure.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2294, and we'll open a work session on 2126.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2126.
House Bill 2126.
And then a different order. House Bill 2126 allows the Employment Department to jointly issue or combine an unemployment benefits overpayment decision with a decision that disqualifies previously paid benefits. Has no revenue impact, has an indeterminate fiscal impact, and we heard this on April 12th, I believe. Maybe April 19th. One of those two.
Just a second right there. Yeah, we had it down, I think, on the 19th. I think the first hearing may be on the 12th, and maybe we carried
maybe
it over.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the 12th is the actual date. Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Ordered. And Senator Wissett, would you be kind enough to carry this one?
Sure.
Senator Wissett will be our carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2126, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2125.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2125 holds Indian tribal employers to the same standards applied to local governments that pay unemployment insurance taxes for extended benefits. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and we heard this on May 12th.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2125 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2125 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll put Senator Burdick as the carrier for 2125. And we'll close the work session on 2125. And now we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 446. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 446 is a medical malpractice bill we have in front of us today. We are up to dash 7 amendments. I put on your desk, if you have it, a little sheet that kind of describes what the amendments do. Basically, they all create a professional, not all of them, some of them create a professional liability fund. Some create excess liability fund, which is more mid-level coverage. Some create efficient physician insurance board. Others create a medical insurance board to be the governing body. Like the Dash 2 amendment creates an Idaho-type screening panel for pre-litigation claims. That is less formal. There's no record. It's not admissible in court. The Dash 3 amendment creates a Dash 4 amendment creates a main type screening panel that's more formal and the record's capped. The Dash 5 amendment, the Dash 7 amendments are capped on attorney's fees, and the Dash 6 amendment talks more about is an excess liability plan as well. I can go into more detail or we can let others talk about it.
I think what we'll do, thank you for the overview on what the amendments are. My understanding is there may be and more than likely will be other amendments that will be before us. Today what I want to do is try to take as much of the public testimony as we can on Senate Bill 446. And if necessary, we will continue public hearing after today. But at this point, I'd like to see how much we can cover. And I have signed up basically what's going to be two panels from OMA and then one individual from the Trial Lawyers Association at this point. So what I'm going to do is first start off with the first panel from OMA. And hopefully I got this right, Peter Bernardo, Monica Welby, and John Moorhead. And if I butchered anyone's name, please correct me, and I apologize before you sit down and correct me.
I'd like to say that wasn't our handwriting. So.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I think I'll lead off of the group. For the record, I'm Peter Bernardo. I'm not sure which letters were there when it was written down. I'm a general surgeon here in Salem, been practicing for the last 13 years. I appreciate the chance to come and speak to you today about how the liability climate in Oregon is affecting physicians and our patients. My colleagues and I have been talking about medical liability insurance reform for 3 years. As you know, we had a very stable insurance market here in Oregon from 1988 to 1999. That stability was a direct result of a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages placed by the legislature back in 1987. In the mid-1980s, much like today, we saw increasing lawsuits and rising premiums, and the effect that was having on the practice of medicine. Physicians were leaving the state. Access to care was in jeopardy. It's really pretty amazing, the work of the legislature in 1987. It was remarkable. They recognized that this was a problem and that it posed a threat to the health of all of our citizens. They recognized that threat, and they acted decisively. Republicans and Democrats from both houses came together to enact reform. The legislation had support of the governor and was backed by the state's physicians, business community, voters, and even most of the major newspapers. Unfortunately, the 1987 reforms did not survive forever. In 1999, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the legislature did not have the constitutional right to place limits. A year later, the voters rejected a referral that would have given the legislature that right. And so, as you might expect, as history has showed us, we know that without that cap, without some sort of limit, without some sort of reform, we're back in trouble. And that's where we are 6 years later. We predicted that professional liability premiums would escalate, and they have. Since 1999, we've seen premiums triple, double for some, and more than triple for others. Other physicians just can't get insurance. Million-dollar-plus settlements and judgments were a rare entity before 1999. We have 35 and counting since then. The number of claims per year hasn't changed, but what's changed is severity. What's changed is the amount you can ask for and the amount you can receive. We knew after the Supreme Court verdict that physicians would once again be making tough decisions. Would they limit high-risk services? The answer is yes, they would. Since 1999, we've seen over a third of our OB care in this state disappear. We knew that physicians would ask tough questions about their practice. Would they retire early? Would they relocate? We've seen 20% or more of our neurosurgeons give up practice or change significantly what they do in that time period. those of us who are trying to recruit to this state know just how difficult it is. We have a difficult environment. We have other states which have enacted reform and in which liability insurance is affordable and which the threat of a career-ending lawsuit doesn't exist. So we're having a tough time recruiting and retaining physicians once we get them to come. Last year, as most of you know, the Oregon Medical Association led the fight to bring back the cap on non-economic damages. Measure 35 was a constitutional amendment to restore the cap. The message to the voters was as simple as we could make it. When we had a cap, we had a stable environment. When we lost the cap, we went once back into a period of instability. I'm not much of a politician. I'm sorry. Measure 35 in this campaign was pretty hard on all of us. The opponents certainly didn't acknowledge the way we saw things. They laughed at our facts. They denied that there was an access to care problem. They were able to manipulate the data and imply that, in fact, there wasn't a shortage of physicians. It was all pretty amazing to us who practice on a day-to-day basis. In the end, they were able to defeat Measure 35 by about 20,000 votes in a record turnout. They won. I think the citizens of Oregon lost. I think the physicians in Oregon certainly lost. Running a business, being a physician, is a complicated business. I don't expect the average citizen to understand Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement, the failings of our Oregon health plan, the plight of the uninsured, or the effect of the medical legal system on how we practice medicine on a daily basis. I do expect that the average Oregonian would recognize when there is a problem and they can't find a doctor. And in fact, 860,000 Oregonians last fall recognized that fact and voted yes on Measure 35. Voters in Jackson County, here in Marion and Polk County, Deschutes County, Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine, just to name a few, voted yes because they see the crisis every day. They have trouble finding a doctor. They have trouble getting health care. They understood the message that this problem is affecting all physicians, and in the end, it's affecting everyone's health. These issues are difficult to understand. I don't necessarily expect the voters to understand them, but I do expect and would hope that the leaders in our society would. I would expect our elected officials to understand that this is a public health issue now, just as it was back in the 1980s. We brought many of these reform issues to the legislature back in 2003. We were disappointed by the response. Last year, 2004, we ran a pretty honest campaign, pretty upfront campaign. I think many of us were frustrated to see that some of our elected officials worked actively against us. We're surprised maybe we shouldn't have been. At some point, I would hope that we realize that we're trying to do what's best for society. So here we are again. It's 2005. We're sitting before the legislature once again talking about issues. I think we all recognize, and I hope you do, that our current system is broken. It doesn't work. We pay a lot of money into a system that, and in the end, only 38% of that premium dollar goes to the patient. That's abysmal. When you look at workman's compensation, where 50 to 60% of that money gets spent out to the injured patient, we're clearly doing something wrong. Where does that majority of the money go to? Goes to the system. It goes to the lawyers. It doesn't go to the patient. Our system ignores many injured workers, right? Many injured patients who truly have claims. It also occasionally gives out a large amount of money to injured people who had a bad outcome but didn't necessarily suffer from malpractice. 80% of the filed claims are closed without payment. That is, they were without merit. They were frivolous, whatever word you wanted to use to describe them. But along the way, it can take 18, 24 months, 3 years sometimes to close those claims. And physicians are forced to wonder, are they still going to be in practice? Is this the one that's not going to be closed? What's going to happen to their future and the future of their families? We as physicians aren't asking that we be absolved of responsibility for our actions. We're not asking that you take us out of the loop. None of us expect to be perfect. We work hard. We work hard to be perfect, but it's unlikely that we're going to be that way. If we make a mistake, if I make a mistake, and one of my patients is injured, I want them to receive compensation. I want them to receive compensation in a fair and timely fashion. That's why I have insurance, because I can't pay it out of my pocket. Unfortunately, I've seen that premium triple in the last 5 years. My premium has gone from $13,000 a year to $35,000 a year since 1999. And I'm not sure where it's going to be next year. At some point, I'm going to ask how much is enough, how much is too much, when is that too much in my bottom line? And more importantly, what happens if I lose a lawsuit for over $1 million, which is my current coverage? What happens to my house, my home, my retirement, my family's future, my college funds for my kids? That's not a question that I like to ask. And it forces me, it forces a lot of physicians to change what we do. You've heard a lot of this before. I know you have. We've talked about it a lot. We've been here before. Senator Prezansky and other members were on the governor's professional panel for the analysis of medical professional liability insurance. I read that report, which unfortunately came out after the election last year. It was a good report. It highlighted most of this. It pointed up the inadequacies of our system, and it did call for change. We're not here asking you for a cap. That's not something you can give us. That's not a remedy that's available to this legislature. But just about everything else is. The legislature has the ability to completely remodel our system, to make something new, to make something better, to make something that keeps physicians practicing in this state, to keep something or to build something that works better for injured patients and their families. You all have the ability to make a system, build a system which is more efficient, more cost-effective, and more equitable. I believe that in time, such a system will be crafted in this state. It has to be. If we don't find a way to enact change, if we don't find a way to keep physicians interested in working in this state, then we will not have a healthcare system. The lesson from other states around the union is that when things get bad enough, when you lose enough physicians, you do get to change. So I have every confidence that you or those who follow you as elected officials in this state will get to change. I'm just not certain how many of us will still be here and working to appreciate it. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. What I want to do is save questions if we can, get the full panel. That way we can open up, because I think we have some expertise throughout this panel, and it may be best to first hear from them, and then we can field questions if your time permits.
Sure.
All right. Please go ahead.
Senator Prezansky and members of the committee, my name's Monica Webby, and I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon. I'm one of the two fellowship-trained pediatric neurosurgeons in the state of Oregon. I practice with five general private practice neurosurgeons, and my practice is based primarily at Emanuel Children's Hospital. Since I've been here, four pediatric neurosurgeons have left the state, and one has retired, leaving us with the two. I'm here to tell you about what's going on in the medical trenches out there, what we're dealing with every day. But first, let me tell you a story. A 10-year-old little boy, the third of four brothers, is working hard at catching up with his brothers on his basketball team. They're all stars on the team. He wants to be a star on the team. He practices all the time. At noon at recess, he and his friends all get together and go play basketball. A few months ago, while he's practicing at lunchtime at noon, he gets a severe headache, and his friends are worried about him. They take him to the school nurse. The school nurse looks at him, and she notices he's kind of confused, so she gets a little nervous and calls the paramedics. They get there about 10 minutes later. They take him to the nearest Greater Metropolitan Area Portland Hospital. So by the time they get him there, it's about 1 o'clock. He's gotten disoriented by now, a little combative. The doctors there examine him, draw some blood, and order a CAT scan to see what's going on. The CAT scan's done by about 1:40. The CAT scan shows a large frontal lobe hemorrhage. The child's got hydrocephalus, and there's signs of increasing pressure on the brain, which is what explains the symptoms. Now, there's a neurosurgeon in the hospital at the time. He's actually a very good vascular neurosurgeon. But he's not called because the patient's a child. He's under 18. So the ER calls Life Flight. They call him to transfer the child to the pediatric hospital. They arrive at 2:15. En route, the child becomes difficult to arouse. He has a seizure, gets a breathing tube. At about 2:45, they make it to the ER. By the time they're at the ER now, the child's comatose. The ER was ready for him. They knew he was coming. So they quickly reviewed the studies, looked at the patient. Everything was done as quickly and efficiently as possible because he was taken to one of the best trauma hospitals, Emmanuel. We've got things set where we run things right through as soon as we can. So the child's taken directly to the operating room. Incision's made at 3:25. This is about 3.5 hours from the time the child had the problem. The neurosurgeon gets in there, the brain's under tremendous pressure, takes the clot out, and the brain follows out behind the clot because the brain's so swollen, can't put the bone flap back in. This means the stroke, the baby's had a stroke. So once the swelling finally subsides about a week later, you can go back and take out the vascular malformation, the abnormal collection that has caused this bleeding in this child. But the child's not going to wake up now. He's comatose. 2 weeks later, he goes for his tracheostomy because he needs the ventilator. He gets a G-tube for feeds because he can't swallow, can't eat. Now, about 3 months later, he's still vegetative. Now, why does this have to happen? Why does a child in Oregon in 2005, with the best health care we have in the world, have to be destroyed by a brain injury, by a blood clot that could have been removed, and his life could have been restored to normal? Why? Because medical liability in Oregon is out of control. This is not an isolated case. This kind of tragedy happens over and over now. The reason? Neurosurgeons in Oregon are either leaving or stopping the treatment of risky cases because they can't afford the liability cost. They're being driven out of practice and away from services that we need and that they can do, but they can't afford to keep providing. The average neurosurgeon is sued every 18 months, not because they're reckless, careless, don't care what they're doing, but because of the high-risk conditions that they treat. Medford recently lost 3 of its 6 neurosurgeons to liability concerns and costs. They left, and there's no one to replace them now. When a neurological emergency happens in Medford on every other weekend or on Thursdays, there's no one on call, and that patient has to be transferred to Eugene or Portland. It takes hours. Vital time is lost. An injury that could have been reversed becomes permanent or worse. You just ask any neurosurgeon at Emmanuel or Sacred Heart how many times they've gotten a report that a patient's awake and talking, and they receive this patient comatose or brain dead. You don't see it because it's a private tragedy, but I see it over and over. And I know why it's happening. It's happening because of the liability crisis. There are no neurosurgeons on the coast. There's none in eastern Oregon. And only one remains in the college town of Corvallis. There's a domino effect that we see up the I-5 corridor as Portland neurosurgeons become stretched increasingly thin. They're resigning privileges at hospitals in order to get off of multiple call schedules because the same few surgeons are covering all the hospitals. We lost 20% of our neurosurgeons in the last 2 years, and 55% are actively exploring opportunities out of state. 40% of those who remain have stopped taking ER call. They've stopped seeing pediatric patients, just like our little boy that's now vegetative. Or they've stopped performing high-risk surgeries because of the liability risk. And the effects multiplied because the fewer specialists there are, the ones who can still see these emergencies and can still handle them, are stretched too thin. The emergency room doctors now have to spend time on the phone, calling around, trying to find a specialist, and then the patient has to be transferred from hospital to hospital. Precious time is lost, and the damage becomes permanent. And our doctors are aging. We're all getting old. 50% of us are over 50, and 36% of the remaining neurosurgeons now plan to retire in the next 5 years. Between doctors retiring and moving out of state, healthcare in Oregon is starting to look like that in a third world country. People are dying of injuries and illnesses that a decade ago would have been treated and cured. And the difference is the liability crisis that's exploded since the cap was removed in 99. It takes a decade to train a neurosurgeon. It only takes an unaffordable premium to lose them. Once they're gone, we can't replace them for years, if not decades. 87% of neurosurgeons say that they can't recruit a new partner. They don't come to states where doctors are leaving, where the liability crisis is acute. They go to states where they can afford to practice and not risk losing everything in a single judgment. There are barely 3,000 neurosurgeons in this country, and there are 800 open jobs. Why would they come here? How bad is it? Medical liability premiums for neurosurgeons and other high-risk specialties in Oregon have tripled since 1999. My own premium went from $25,000 to $72,000 for one-fifth the level of coverage. I can only get 1 in 3 coverage now. I had 5 in 5 before. So I'm at more risk than ever. And my problem is every specialist's problem in Oregon. 91% of Oregon's neurosurgeons are unable to get the coverage they need. But what's the most tragic about this? The most tragic is the fact that we can no longer afford to treat the patients and the emergencies that we want to treat, to provide the specialized care we trained so long to learn and have the experience and the facilities to do. The crisis is real. It's getting worse each year because we're losing doctors we can't replace. The obstetricians are also hard hit, and since 1999, 34% have stopped delivering babies, and another 10% plan to stop within the year. I find it ironic that by suing obstetricians when a baby has cerebral palsy, we actually increase the risk of cerebral palsy in future infants by decreasing their access to obstetricians. The current liability climate increases the likelihood of bad outcomes, especially in obstetric and neurosurgical patients where the resultant lack of doctors willing to risk providing the care has led to delays in treatment and irreversible damage and death. This problem can be fixed. There was no crisis before 1999. There's a growing crisis since 1999. The answer is simple. Restore medical liability reform and stop the hemorrhage of Oregon's doctors leaving their practices and the tragic consequences for our patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Moorhead.
Thank you, Senator Pruzanski, members of the committee. I'm John Moorhead. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Medical Association. I'm a practicing emergency physician. I practice at OHSU, and as such, I'm covered under state tort liability protection. So unlike my colleagues, I don't have a financial interest in this discussion. My motivation for being involved in this discussion is an intense concern for access to health care for services for citizens in the state of Oregon. Emergency physicians, my colleagues across the state, often see patients in their time of crisis when they have no other access to timely medical care. We have an access crisis in this state. I won't go over the numbers. You've just heard them. I just returned from a meeting in Washington, D.C. of researchers who study healthcare workforce. This was sponsored by the AAMC, the Association of Academic Medical Centers. The consensus of those attending the meeting is that the projection, which from earlier this year, that there will be a 15% physician workforce nationally, is too conservative. And we, a member of that group, now predicts that there will be at least a 20% national physician shortfall for the next 15 years, despite anticipated expansion of medical school enrollment. We hope to see that here in Oregon. Obviously, this situation will exacerbate any of the situation and access issues that we have in the state. What this means is that states like Oregon are going to be in a competitive position trying to recruit and retain doctors for the foreseeable future. States that have an attractive practice environment will attract and retain physicians. The liability environment is a major aspect of the current practice environment. I note that several states adjacent to Oregon have more favorable liability and reimbursement environments. It's with this knowledge and the previously mentioned access problems that physicians have sought reasonable solutions to the current liability crisis in Oregon. I and we were pleased with the Senate leadership, Senators Bates and Ringo, for convening a liability reform group comprised of doctors and trial attorneys. This process stimulated creative solutions and collegial discussion based on the unanimous agreement of the workforce participants that there was, in fact, a workforce shortage and that this is escalating, particularly in non-urban areas of the state. All members learned from each other and focused on meaningful reform, translating into premium relief for physicians. The physician stated repeatedly, pretty much I believe at every meeting, that a PLF proposal in itself would itself provide no anticipated premium relief. The group gained consensus on a package of proposals, which together was anticipated to provide significant premium relief. The focus of this package was both a pre-trial screening panel and the development of an excess fund with a funding source other than physician sponsorship. Physicians believe that a pre-trial screening process that is admissible in any eventual trial is a significant detriment to proceeding when an unfavorable decision is made by the panel. Our understanding of such a process in the state of Maine has resulted in only, I was told in meeting with them just a couple months ago, two cases, one on the plaintiff's side, one on the defense side, in which they elected to proceed to trial in the face of an unfavorable decision made by the panel. The resulting increased efficiency in the system translates directly into a decrease in liability premiums. The establishment of an excess fund that provides coverage above a reasonable limit allows for partial support of physicians' liability premiums, if only if funded from an outside source. This fund would again result in premium relief for physicians. Physicians were surprised, members of the group, the physicians who participated in that group were surprised to find that the focus of the proposed legislation we're discussing this afternoon was the establishment of a PLF and a non-admissible pretrial screening panel. Neither of these proposals is thought to provide meaningful premium relief for physicians. Unless we return to strategies proven to reduce liability premiums, we will stand by and watch the access problems for all Oregonians predictably worsen until a terrible situation causes the public to demand emergency liability reform. Let us not miss the opportunity to craft a collaborative, creative, workable package of proposals to provide meaningful liability reform. We look forward to continuing to participate in that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and open the panel for questions and give people here at the panel first opportunity to ask questions, and then I would like to ask a few. Senator Bates, do you have any questions?
Well, I'd just like to thank you all for coming today. I think you've expressed yourself extremely well and laid out what I think are the basics of the problems we're facing. I understand there are certain restrictions in the Senate as far as raising revenue that have to occur on the other side of this building, okay? So that answers one of your questions, and we'll discuss others as we go along. But I appreciate you outlining what you were talking about, and you were correct in stating the physician's point of view and their feelings about the work group of what they thought was coming out of that. I appreciate your synopsis of that. Thank you. Nice to see all three of you here. Thanks for coming.
Senator Vingo.
Thank you for coming this afternoon. And Dr. Moorhead, I very much appreciate your work during our little work group. I think there was a lot of good communication. I just want to put a couple things on the table. One is the goal, it's a very, very important goal to make physician premiums more affordable and more stable so that we have good access to care in all specialties and in all parts of Oregon. But that can't be the only goal. We also have to respect the access to justice system, and we also have to work towards patient safety. And I think that was one of the things that came out in the work group as we were balancing all those objectives. It was disappointing to me that we weren't able to really come to some grand consensus that we thought could do those things, because I think that's what we need to do to serve the people in our state. And I guess just one other comment is that in clamoring for tort reform, I think we have to really be specific about what we're asking for and what impact it might have. One of the things that came up during our work group was that the medical community has often advocated for expert witness discovery as an important tool in processing medical liability claims, and And there was information from the state of Washington that said if you have expert witness discovery, it triples the cost of defending claims. It vastly increases the expense of processing the claims. It increases expense for both sides. And it can be a handy tool for one side to have to use against the other side, but it doesn't achieve the objective of reducing the defense costs and reducing the flow of money to attorneys. And so I just want to suggest that I think we do need to reform the system in some significant ways. I was disappointed we didn't reach a consensus in our group. I think we need to be careful about how we do it. But again, I appreciate your work, Dr. Moorhead, and I very much honor all the work you three do as physicians.
A response, I think Dr. Moorhead would be the first to say that with regards to patient safety, we spent the 2003 legislature, Oregon Medical Association, ramrodding a patient safety act through and getting it signed. And it currently is financed primarily by physicians in the Oregon Medical Association. So you're right. That is an issue. It's an issue that's at the forefront of this discussion. We want a better system, and we're very much advocates for it. Our concern is that you don't get to talk about patient safety if you don't have doctors and patients, and we're looking at not having doctors. In response to the identification of defense expert witnesses as one of the issues of tort reform, Oregon is one of two states in the union that doesn't have that, and it does exist in federal court already in this state. So perspective is important, I guess, when we talk about this. You're right. We want to look at issues which will help. We're interested in staying in practice. We're interested in seeing our premiums stay at a better level. And I think it's important to point out that it's that mega lawsuit, which is all the more common in this state, that is really worrying specialists. You're looking at a neurosurgeon who's every day is on the line for a multimillion-dollar lawsuit, and that's the end of her career if she loses that. And so we're willing to talk about anything. We're willing to look at anything that provides some relief. We're more than willing to support patient safety efforts, and we are and have been.
Mr. Paul, Mr. Chair, I completely understand. You don't want all of your life savings, your assets, your future riding on one thing, and I think we need to work for some sort of umbrella to try to do that to keep people in the state.
Senator Byer, do you have any questions?
I'd like to make a couple of comments, and maybe you can respond to them. As you mentioned, Dr. Bernardo, I had the opportunity to sit on that task force panel during the interim, and actually, because of the work we did in 2003, was invited back to Washington, D.C. for a presentation of basically states in health crisis and present what we had done in here in the state of Oregon as it pertained to trying to maintain rural access to doctors. During that presentation, what I learned at that time was that there are a number of states in the country that are under what I would call those nationwide liability crisis and just health crisis, and they had been identified as such based on different variables. But the one point that was brought up to me was that of those states that had been identified as in this health crisis, half of them had caps and half of them did not. And we had someone present to us from Pennsylvania. We heard about what happened in Texas, my birth state. And so I'm very familiar, and then also Florida and some other places. But as we've worked through this, and I was able to shadow the work group that's been meeting during this session, it's trying to look at what we can or can't do. Now, the cap issue, one of the amendments that we have is actually dealing with caps. And I don't see how we, again, as the legislature, are able to even consider that, knowing that that actually has to go back to the voters to open the door for that to even be considered. And if we know that some of the states that are in these medical crisis status do have caps and others do not, it seems to me maybe we could look what within the confines of what our limitations are and what can we build to give the relief, because what I hear is that the cost of your premiums have gotten to the point of where you're questioning, is it viable for you to stay here with your families at risk as to if there was a claim filed and it was found to be with merit for whatever reasons, that it could in fact impact not only what your coverage rates are. So One of the questions I have is, I guess, is for since Dr. Moorhead is not within that area of paying out premiums, since he has the state umbrella, the current amount of premiums that each of you are paying, and can you please tell us if that is your base coverage or is part of that premium include your excess coverage? Because one of the issues that we've looked at is if we had a attorney-type PLF, that would be building premiums being pooled and shared at the intro level, or an excess coverage would be after you pay your own for up to $500,000 is what's on the table right now, then you would have the protection for the excess. So if you can give some guidance as to what each of you currently incur as to your premiums and what that means.
Sure. I guess I'm not aware of any physician who has excess coverage. So the standard arrangement is you pay your premium for the per occurrence and total year net. So I have a $1 million occurrence, $3 million a year total net for my malpractice coverage. That is through Northwest Physicians Mutual here in town. And that premium that I pay, $35,000 a year, covers that. So Northwest Physicians Mutual agrees to cover me for $1 million per occurrence. If it's over that, then it becomes potluck. I'll let Dr. Webby comment on her insurance and our
for the rest of your question.
Well, I mentioned in my little testimony that originally we had five million and five. That was aggregate.
Yeah.
No, we had five and five originally, and now our insurance company will only give us one in three. We can't get more than one in three, and that's the problem with neurosurgeons. The neurosurgeons, when I mentioned that 91% of us are unhappy with the amount of coverage we can get, that's all we can get is one in three,
mm-hmm.
And they don't even offer more. We're with the doctor's company, so the different insurance companies are, you know, that's just all they're going to give you, and so that's all you have. So you don't have an excess fund. And then when I just want to make a quick point, you're making a comment about the caps and that some of the states in crisis have caps, some don't. The problem with that is that the caps are so variable. Some states have $1 million cap, some of them have a $250,000 cap, and some of the caps are so penetrable, there's so many holes in them that they're not even caps at all. And in addition, when you're looking at those numbers, some of those that were considered cap states had just had the cap put in 1 or 2 years ago, and they're considering it as a cap state when the cap was put in because the crisis was so bad that the cap had to come in and it hasn't had time to work. So you really have to be careful when you're looking at some of those studies, I use that term loosely, out there comparing capped versus non-capped states. But as far as excess funds, there really isn't an excess fund.
Not as it currently stands. So again, our message to you is there are two issues. Number one is the amount of premium we have to pay in a given year, and the fact that it's risen every year for the last 5 years. And number two is what happens with that multi-million-dollar judgment, and how do you find a way to rein that in? How do you find a way to still get good compensation to a patient, and yet not destroy a physician for one mistake against 10,000 good decisions in that year? So I don't have a good recommendation for you. Obviously, we can't talk about a cap as it is structured currently. I would tell you that the amendment that looks at a total limit is looking at it as that as a acceptable remedy, and I would leave that to the next group of representatives to explain why they think that might be constitutional.
Okay.
Obviously, workman's compensation system has been ruled constitutional over the years in this state, and that is a remedy which takes away your right to seek a jury trial and judgment. So somehow there's a system there that potentially could be crafted. I don't know that that's going to happen today.
I would just add that, you know, we can learn from other states, but we can also be misled. And clearly we want to learn from other states and what's worked there. And when we looked at, for example, the pre-screening panels, we looked at other states and you know, the model you have in front of you is from Idaho. They have both now with the amendment, but the original was the Idaho model, which of course is in a situation where they have a $250,000 cap. And so it's a different kind of a discussion, a whole different sort of set of circumstances. When we looked for other states that had similar environment to Oregon, we found Maine, and that's why you have, I think it's Dash 4, which is the main proposal or the main pre-screening panel, and we've talked to folks there, and it works there, and that seems the environment most close. We're not trying to have any kind of a rhetoric. We're trying to learn from each other. I think the other point that you make is, you know, when we look at these proposals, if we pool all the doctors, what kind of numbers are we looking at? And it looks like the numbers are pretty far apart. We've heard numbers of 11,000. Our numbers seem to suggest 41,000. We talked to the pediatricians in Salem and said, if it's 41,000, what does that mean to you? And they currently pay 16. They said we're out of business. So it shouldn't be hard for us to find out what that number is, and then we can deal with it. We don't need to be dealing with all these estimates, and I think we've got some numbers coming in a later panel.
And I would say that the pediatricians at 16 are already wondering about their practice because it used to be 6. So.
And just real quick with regard to the pre-litigation screening panels, so I was just a few weeks ago at one of our national neurosurgery meetings at the Council of State Neurosurgical Societies, and there's representatives from every state there, and we were talking about, of course, you know, tort reform's huge for neurosurgeons. It's our major number one, you know, people are, it's a disaster for us. And I could go on and on about that, but I won't. But my point was that the states that have pre-litigation screening that's non-discoverable, the neurosurgeons have seen no improvement at all. The only states that were saying it even worked at all had discoverable pre-litigation screening. Admissible. Yeah. Sorry.
That's fine.
I'm not an attorney, obviously.
Scott
going, God, shut her up.
But you are a doctor in a day.
But whatever.
Go back.
Well, I spent all my time focusing on other things.
That's right. So I will point out that I have a friend who was a neurosurgeon who left the state, went to Idaho, and actually has come back. I have not had the opportunity to talk to him as to, you know, why he chose to come back. I know that he left for the reasons that you mentioned.
Right.
But I know what a reason he is back. Maybe the bicycling's better over here. I'm not sure.
What you find is a lot of neurosurgeons who are still working here but cut out the intracranial work,
right.
which drops a fair amount of their risk out of their practice.
A lot of the insurance companies will drop your premium by 30% if you drop intracranial. And then when you drop intracranial, you drop trauma.
Right. Is there any other questions for this panel?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one more point to that. You've done a great job, but there's another point that needs to be made of why we're in trouble in the state. First off, there is a shortage of physicians, which people in this country don't appreciate. In primary care, we're only filling half our residencies right now, mm-hmm. and we wouldn't be filling those weren't for foreign medical graduates. So we have a shortage of physicians. Now we're going to be competing in Oregon for mm-hmm. physicians, and we're competing in an uneven field, not only because of Med-Mal, but because Oregon is extremely low in reimbursement rates in Medicare and Medicaid for physicians, and that's over half of these people's income.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a neurosurgeon or obstetrician or a primary care physician comes and says, I want to come to Oregon because it's a great place to live, and then we tell them what Med-Mal is, and we tell them what he'll probably get paid or she will probably get paid, they say thank you very much and they move on.
Right.
We have an aging physician population. We have physicians retiring very early. The reason we have a neurosurgery problem in Medford is we're down to 3 where we should have 7. They're all personal friends of mine. 2 of them are looking for the possibility of leaving, and we could drop in Medford, a major area of our state, to have no trauma coverage at all. I couldn't believe living there for 25 years, we have no neurosurgery coverage for Thursdays and every other weekend. I mean, it's insane. We're sitting on top of I-5.
Mm-hmm.
But that's our situation, and we have to resolve this issue. So when we're going through this, remember that these people are being caught between very low reimbursement rates, which we can do nothing about. It's a federal problem, and very high premiums on their insurance. And the premiums here, if you compare to states that are in trouble, are really not much higher. The difference for many of these people is the difference in what their income is and what their risk for their personal lives is if they have a case against them that wipes them out. So keep in mind, we have more than one issue here going on, and these people are being squeezed right now. I will admit, I have a little conflict of interest here. I'm still a practicing physician,
oh, yeah.
by the way.
You have time to do that?
Yeah.
And I think we're actually...
Weekends are made for, and it's not Michelob.
I think we're also will hear that maybe there is some stuff that we could do on the reimbursement rates as it pertains to within the state. I think Mr. Gallant will probably give us a little bit of that information since I've heard it at least twice before. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to call the... Before I call the next panel up, we do have people that are here, individuals from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Members, what I'm going to ask is they are here and can give us at this point, if we wanted it, some of the, I guess it would be the impacts on the rates for what the different amendments have. I personally would like to go ahead and continue the public testimony and then, if necessary, have you come back later. Corey, I understand you may need to leave at 4:30. Michael, you may be able to stay here. If we get through, I'd like to take that today. And so... but I have at least four more people, one more panel to come forward, and I want to get that testimony on the record before we really start getting, because I know we're going to have some more amendments coming forward. So with that said, and the nods I got from my members, Mr. Gallagher, Mr. Carew, and Mr. Gallant. And do you have a specific order?
Dr. Gallagher.
All right. Dr. Gallagher, why don't you go ahead and identify you. Yourself and give us your testimony.
Chairman Prozanski, Senator Meyer, Ms. Braun. I'm Dr. Bill Gallagher. I'm an orthopedic surgeon here in Salem and have been for the past 30 years, which qualifies me quite nicely for that over 50 group, I think. But also, though, for the last 25 years, I've been president and chairman of Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company, which, as you probably know, is our state is a doctor-owned medical malpractice company. It was started by a group of Salem physicians in 1983, and we've been active since that time. We insure about half of the physicians in the state of Oregon. And this company is, in effect, a professional liability insurance company in that it is owned by professionals and it provides only medical liability insurance. I was going to spend a little time talking about what a crisis we have in the state, but you've heard it all and heard it very well, so I'm going to skip that part of it. But I do want to make a comment about patient safety that Senator Ringel talked about, and not many people know, but our company spends $750,000, roughly $750,000 a year, on patient safety issues, and we have for many years. We do it through education of our physicians in reducing risk and improving quality of care for patients. And I think the other thing to point out is that we talked about premiums being high. I would say that premiums that the doctors are paying and they're concerned about these premiums being high is certainly a concern, but I think the bigger concern is the worry about the large verdict and the loss of assets. I think that is more anxiety-provoking for physicians than paying a double premium. Dr. Wiebe is correct when she says that her premiums have gone up. Our company does not insure her, but we do insure neurosurgeons, and we do offer over $5 million coverage, and that coverage is now $122,000 a year. If they want to drop back to $1 million, $5 million, it'll be $72,000. Next year, $82,000. That's a fairly large chunk of cash. What we really need to do, working collaboratively, is to come up with some good common sense solutions to this liability problem. We at MDM think that pre-litigation screen panels are one way to help stabilize this problem. We use the system in Idaho where we insure physicians. We've been very happy with the Idaho model. It's different than the Maine model, as you know, and those differences I'm sure can be reconciled. Both are screening panels. One is much more formal than the other. We prefer the less formal because it's cheaper. It's quicker. And it's less anxiety-provoking for the physicians. So we would support the -3 amendments primarily of the screening panels. We also think that a medical excess liability fund would be a stabilizing mechanism. We support this concept, as pointed out in -6 amendments. We feel that such a fund would help level liability costs across specialties because it spreads out large losses among all physicians. And it also would be an incentive to provide insurance coverage in the state of Oregon. By removing the volatility of large losses, it would encourage more companies to enter the state, which in turn would provide more competition and probably lower premiums, as you all know. We now have two companies in Oregon that offer medical malpractice insurance primarily. That's us and CNA. We also would support any limitation on contingency fees. And that's all I have to add at this time. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
What I'm going to do is have everyone testify, and then we'll open up the panel for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Director of Government Affairs of the Oregon Medical Association. I am going to present some highlights of two reports that are attached to my testimony that have been recently conducted. The first report is titled "The Potential Impact of Various Medical Malpractice Liability Changes in Oregon." It was conducted by Pinnacle Resources, Inc., which is an actuarial firm who conducted the interim study from last year, of which, Mr. Chair, you were a participant. The second document is a public opinion poll that was conducted by More Information last weekend, again on a variety of issues. I have given you all of both documents, the good, the bad, and the indifferent, for you to review. I'll just highlight them. But before I get to those two reports...
Again, can I just ask a question? I'm looking at what's being handed out. Do you know how many copies you brought in?
I brought a ton, about 20.
Cool. Okay.
And since I have a bad back, I was thinking about, no, probably workers' comp. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, excuse me. Before I get to the most recent reports, I wanted to reiterate some of the top-line points of the 2004 Pinnacle report that I believe all legislators received and I'm sure immediately put under tables to level them for balance. It's a very thick document. Here are some of the highlights from the previous interim work, which was distributed in November of 2004. The medical malpractice mechanism is less efficient than the mechanisms for workers' compensation and private passenger auto in terms of the proportion of dollar going directly to claimants. In fact, more than 50% of insurance company outflows go to claimants in each of the other lines of business. We estimate that less than 40%, it's actually 38%, of insurance company medical malpractice payments are received by the claimants. If a system could be developed to resolve medical malpractice liability claims as efficiently as workers' compensation, it would reduce medical malpractice premiums by up to 30%. These estimates assume no reduction in payments to injured patients, no change in insurance company underwriting expenses. Most of the increase in loss and defense cost ratios is due to increases in pure loss ratios, as defense costs have remained about the same percentage of premiums. Medical malpractice claim frequencies appear to be steady to declining over the last several years. Medical malpractice claim severities, which were relatively steady in the 1990s, began a steady upward trend in 1997 and increased at an annual rate of 25% over the next 6 years. In another study that the Oregon Medical Association commissioned and was produced by Eco Northwest, they found the claim frequency since 1987 declined 54%, while the average payment increased 449%. Payments for claims that exceed $1 million now constitute 11% of paid claims, and 52% of total dollars paid, or a 225% increase over the last 20 years. Since 1999, the average medical liability payment has grown by 90%, from $247,000 to $470,000. Coincident with the growth in amounts paid and the number of high payout claims, malpractice premiums have grown by as much as 330% in some specialties. The primary conclusions of the most recent Pinnacle report are essentially as follows. A mandatory PLF where everyone pays the same would present a significant number of material risks to the state of Oregon and to its healthcare providers. The PLF model without some external subsidy would result in no reduction in expected losses and possibly higher losses due to claims handling and higher premiums. A model of this type would be, quote, grossly, unfairly discriminatory by creating massive subsidies between different specialties. An excess liability fund is a common approach to improving rate stability and increasing market competition. However, without other medical malpractice reforms and or some form of premium subsidy does not necessarily always provide a better approach to medical malpractice insurance, just a different one. An approach that included a subsidized excess loss fund would have the dual effect of encouraging private insurance companies to enter the state and provide the basic coverage component and would further reduce malpractice premiums through the subsidy. States with excess liability funds generally have more favorable, have more affordable rates and lower loss ratios. A pre-litigation screening panel, as generally proposed in Senate Bill 1090, and I've forgotten which dash amendments they are because I'm over 50, similar to those currently in place in the state of Maine, would reduce expected malpractice losses by approximately 9%. A $500,000 cap on non-economic damages would have the effect of reducing expected losses by 15%. Caps on attorney's fees, similar to the state of California, would offset 75% of the reductions in patient compensation created by the non-economic damage caps. That is a significant point, I might add. And finally, from the Pinnacle report, the most recent one, states with caps on non-economic damages and attorney contingency fees generally have more affordable rates and lower cost ratios. What the OMA has learned through this report is that if the state's goals are to stabilize and to reduce the cost of liability premiums, all of the various parts of the liability system must be addressed. Otherwise, all our efforts could well make the current circumstances worse for physicians, patients, and the state. We also conducted, as I mentioned, a Bob Moore information poll, which found these top three line points. Oregonians, by a large majority, 69% believe that doctors are leaving their practices or are retiring because of increasing liability costs. Those polled are concerned that this may impact the availability and quality of care that they receive. A large majority of voters support limiting contingency fees by substantial margins, I might add. And there is substantial support, 73%, for establishing pre-litigation screening panels where the findings of the panel are admissible in court. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there are other findings in both reports. I would, again, encourage you to review those when you have the opportunity. I most certainly appreciate the opportunity to make my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Crewe. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney & Crewe in Portland, and we're general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. My job here today was to bat cleanup and to try to explain to you the so-called medical legal panel proposed by the OMA, which is the Dash 4 amendments, and the medical excess liability plan, which are the Dash 6 amendments. You also have been given two documents that are beige in color. I'll just briefly explain those for you. I'm not going to go through them. The first document, entitled Maine's Mandatory Pre-Litigation Screening and Mediation Panels for Medical Malpractice Actions, this is an overview that was prepared by Maine. It's not by the owners. It's their document. The second document was prepared by our office, the State Medical Malpractice Pre-Litigation Screening Panels. It's a comparison of the Maine model to the Idaho model, point by point. So hopefully that will help you as you consider the various amendments.
Mr. Crude, since we're on the record and just making sure I understand, the first document, which is, says Maine's Mandatory Pre-Litigation Screening on the first line, at the bottom it says prepared by what I would be the MMA, the Maine
yes.
Medical Association.
Yes.
And the second one is a one that was prepared by your firm at the request of OMA.
That's correct.
And the data that you're using for that that information is basically just straight out of their statutes?
Correct. We just basically went down through the two acts from the two states and compared them.
Just making, I just want to put a few things on the record so everyone knows that might be listening in the future where we're getting the information and what it's based on. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to quickly go through the Dash 4 and the Dash 6 amendments because obviously, I think there's going to be a fair amount of debate among you about whether or not they have any merit, and I don't want to spend a lot of your time going through this. But essentially, the Dash 4 Amendment, which is the medical legal panel or the Maine model, I want to point out a couple of very important features of that in your thoughts and you go through this. Number one is that, of course, it must be very broad in the definition of a health care claim to sweep in all potential medical malpractice claims. Secondly, and this is very important, that the list of participants in that be very broad, not just physicians, not MDs, DOs, podiatrists. The one thing that I think that's creative about the model that we've put in the Dash 4 amendments is that it is very broad and it's going to cost some money to fund. That funding will come from people like Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, and the other three doctors who are sitting up here.
It won't come from me. I'll pay my share.
Right.
Okay. But if the participating panel or the participating individuals and entities are broad enough, such as hospitals, which would pay on the basis of the number of beds, you know, you probably can keep this down to something less than $40 or $50 a year for a physician to have this panel in place in order to compensate panel participants, retired physicians, attorneys who indicate they're interested in being on these panels, etc. And there's going to be expenses, and this is should be a self-funding proposition, and that's the way we set up the Dash 4 amendments. Participation is mandatory. I won't pick on Senator Bates, but if Dr. Moorhead, although he's exempt under the Tort Claims Act, but let's take him out of that so I can pick on him. If he doesn't pay his $40 or $50, the BME will let him know that he's not going to be practicing medicine until he does. So it's set up as mandatory participation. We set up in the proposal to take effect on July 1 of 06 to give the opportunity for the panel to be set up, the mechanisms, etc. The way it essentially works is that there will be a notice of a health care claim filed in the circuit court, and I'm not going to get into those details because I think we're going to lose some of the time we have.
That's fine.
But our purpose was to move it very quickly. Essentially, from the time the health care claim is filed in the circuit court, notice of health care claim, first the statute of limitations is told, and then secondly, that case will be decided within 120 days by the panel. The panel is administered, if you will, by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. His or her role is very minor. It's just keeping the list of participants and providing that to the circuit court judges so they'll know who they can appoint. The point that is important in our view is that, unlike Idaho, where the plaintiff comes in or the claimant comes in and says, this is why I was injured, and this is the person that did it to me, and this is why I think I should win. And then that claimant leaves. no cross-examination, and then the defendant comes in. Now, it's beyond me how in Idaho the defendant knows what the plaintiff is complaining about, but apparently they do. And I'm not criticizing the Idaho procedure. I'm just simply saying it's not a procedure, in my view, that gives a great deal of notice to the one both sides as to exactly what the issues are. I might add that the Idaho model is a House bill that Northwest put up, and a very well-known plaintiff's attorney appeared at that hearing and just raged at the members of the House who were on the panel about what a travesty this was, in the sense that it was denial of due process, that they couldn't be cross-examined, etc. The main model provides for all that, but on a very truncated basis. You don't follow the rules of evidence, and you're encouraged to keep it short. The other thing that our proposal does, and this I want to speak to something that Senator Ringo said, and that is, it does require the claimant to reveal the identity of the experts and to put in their written statement. It is beyond me how a panel could begin to decide a case either for or against a physician without knowing all the facts, including what the opinion of the expert is. With the exception of very few cases in this state, what we call the res ipsa cases, you must have an expert in that courtroom testifying to that jury or the court as to what the standard of care was and how it was breached. If you don't have that, you lose as a matter of law. What we're suggesting is that should be told to the panel. Doesn't mean that you get to depose the expert. Doesn't mean that you get to put the expert under cross-examination in the hearing room, because the expert won't be there. It'll just be their sworn statement. It seems to me that something like this has merit. But in the end, the most important part of the Dash 4 proposal is that after there has been an opportunity to have a fair and equal airing of the issues, that panel makes a decision, and that decision is admissible. A majority of that panel of 3 or 4 or 5, whatever it may be, is admissible in a subsequent trial. Now, it's important to understand that in the Dash 4 Amendment, when the jury is told that a panel heard this matter, they're equally told that they don't have to follow the panel's proposal or the panel's findings. They're simply told that a panel heard it, and the panel either found for or against the physician. That's it. That's all that's provided for. And I suggest to you, and we've done our research on this, we're fairly confident that that is, in fact, constitutional. We have, in this state, in our evidence code, we have all kinds of rules relative to evidence that set up presumptions and that sort of thing. And that is not found to be somehow a violation of the jury's right to decide a fact. If there's a rebuttable presumption, I suggest to you that's even worse than being told that the panel has made a finding and what that finding was. Although you're allowed to be, the jury's told, but you don't have, you can ignore what the panel did. My point is, both in Maine, where this has been tested constitutionally, and we believe here in Oregon it would be found constitutional. I think that really does cover the majority of the major points on the Dash 4 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments are the medical excess liability plan. And essentially, without going into a great deal of detail, that plan is set up. First, it's mandatory participation. It's a condition of licensure in the state of Oregon. As a physician, if you're going to practice, you have to be insured. That is not the law now. Physicians can go bare. Secondly, that it says that a licensed physician, in order to meet the requirements of the Dash 6 proposal, is you must have a policy of at least $500,000, $1.5 million aggregate annual coverage. It's $500,000 per occurrence, $1.5 million aggregate. It goes on to say that there will be an excess pool set up. And that pool will provide excess coverage above that of the physician. And the excess pool would provide coverage up to $2 million. So in the first claim, if we had 4 train wrecks, if you will, in a given year by one physician, each for, let's say, $5 million, on the first claim, the doctor's policy would pay out $500,000. The excess fund would pay out $1.5 million. And I will get to the point that is all you get. that is an absolute cap on recovery if you're an injured party. And I want to speak to the point you raised regarding caps. But that's the way it works, and if you go through, when you get to the fourth train wreck, the doctor's policy has been exhausted, and by the Dash 6 amendments, the excess liability fund would become the primary insurer, not the excess insurer, but the primary, and it would pay out $2 million to the injured plaintiff. And if you had six train wrecks, same thing. 10 train wrecks, same thing. That's the way it's set up. It also provides that the Rural Medical Liability Fund, which was created by the 03 session of the legislature, any excess monies would be transferred over to this fund to allow that certain parts of this particular piece of legislation be put in place to study what the cost of this is. Now, it's important to understand, and we've told the physicians this, you folks are going to be pushing something here that you don't know what the cost of it is. You may not be able to afford it. It may not provide you any rate relief. And in fact, you put a burden on your shoulders that says you must have this in order to practice here. So what we've done is we've said, okay, here's the proposal. The commission or this body, this excess liability fund, will be set up by this session, by this legislature, but it will not take effect until January 1 of 08. And the notion was, is, and there's a provision that says that this body must study what the cost of this is going to be and other fixes that need to be put in place, because I'm going to tell you right now, we've not had the best and last thought on this. It was just a vehicle to get people to work on it. And during the interim, have anyone, the plaintiff's bar, the defense bar, the OMA, anyone else that cares to comment upon this and say how it can be made better or what needs to happen to it. So that then we can come back in the 07 session and fix what needs to be fixed, but also know what it's going to cost. And if the physicians can't afford what it's going to cost, then this bill will sunset before it takes effect. That the provisions of the bill that require mandatory participation. The notion was don't rush into the void without having answers, and that's what we're trying to avoid here. Finally, this is an exclusive remedy. An injured Oregonian would have under this bill, if it were to pass, this proposal, if it was to pass, they would receive $2 million. I might add that the cap on non-economic damages in death cases, which is still the law in the state of Oregon, would still be in place under this bill. But in a death case, it would still be limited to a total of $2 million, and in a non-death personal injury case, it would be limited to $2 million. Now, how is that? How could this body do this in view of the Lakin v. Senko case, the 99 case, and not be walking right back into the bear trap? And the answer is simple, but yet it certainly is, the arguments will be complex from the plaintiff's bar, and I appreciate that. But if you read, and I'm sure you have, but I'll remind you that in the state of Oregon, the Lakin v. Senko case was a case that looked at the right to a jury trial. Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution. And that's what the court said. The problem is you're denying the plaintiff the right to an unfettered jury trial. But what Lakin v. Senko also said, as does the case of Lawson v. Hoke, which is a court of appeals case, and Smothers versus Gresham Transfer. Gresham Transfer is a client of mine. What those cases said was this body, this legislature, has the absolute right to take away a remedy, a common law remedy, but you must replace it with an adequate remedy if you're not going to violate Article 1, Section 10, which is the remedies clause of the Oregon Constitution. Ergo, the reason why you can have a workers' compensation system. Otherwise, in common law in 1857, an injured worker had the right to sue their employer and get every dollar the employer was worth. But you put in place, back in the early 60s, the workers' compensation system, and it's withstood constitutional challenge. Well, that's the notion of why a $2 million absolute cap could, in fact, be held constitutional under Article 1, Section 10. Will it? I don't know. I authored the 1987 cap amendment. I thought for sure we were safe under Article 1, Section 17, and I was proven wrong. Whether or not a $2 million remedy is adequate will be left to the court to decide. But that's how you could put an absolute cap in place if you were of a mind to. Beyond that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Prue. Questions from the panel, or from the members for the panel? I have just a couple questions. And Mr. Gallagher, or Dr. Gallagher, excuse me, regarding your when you have your hat on as on the insurer's side, if there's a problem with a doctor in the sense of there's a payout because of something that he or she has done, can you walk us through as to what, if any, steps does the insurance company use to try to address? And I understand that you've put $750,000 in safety issues, but can you tell us what type of remedial type of maybe work you might use, understanding that some cases it just happens, and it's other cases where you think that maybe some assistance might be appropriate.
Every claim, excuse me, Senator Brzezinski, every claim is looked at by the claims committee, which consists of 10 physicians, and is evaluated for its merit. And as you know, 80% of those we find are not, they have no merit, and therefore we elect to defend those. So the other 20% we're talking about, 15 to 20%, where there might be some fault involved by the physician. We look at it medically. If it's, you know, very seldom is it a case of egregious care. And so if it's someone's first claim, for instance, we probably would do nothing. If there's not egregious care. If there is egregious care, then we our process would be to refer that physician on for another look by the underwriting committee, which is a group of physicians. We might at that point decide that we no longer wish to take the risk on that physician. We might decide that this physician just had a bad day, needs some help, maybe it's a systems problem, which it usually is. We can go into the office and help them with their systems to see if we can prevent this from ever happening again. Seldom, you know, for physicians are not going to lose their insurance for one claim, 99.9% of the time.
Okay.
So we do have mechanisms in place to deal with a physician who needs some help.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Gallagher, regarding the Board of Medical Examiners, can you give us any information on that same type of perspective? I mean, one of the things that has been shared with me, there may be, just like in any profession, certain group of individuals that may be running the cost up because of maybe they have more prone to problems or issues. And that runs across any profession, of course.
Could I say one thing before that? I would say that, you know, you hear the fact that there are 5% of the doctors that cause all of the problems, 95% of the problems. And that is true. And I looked at that in our company, and every year about 5% of our doctors have suits against them. But every year it's a different 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So one would think eventually in 20 years, 100% of the docs ought to be gone that are causing you problems, yet we're 23, 24 years into existence, we're still having the same 5% problem. So that argument has no merit in my mind.
Right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't have said it the same way, but I would have responded similarly in the sense that we have looked at the issue, and it comes up every time of whether a small percentage of physicians are causing substantial outlays and liability suits or settlements. And we have never been able to confirm that. In fact, it's just the opposite. That was true in the 1980s when he was authoring the legislation on limiting liability and other changes in the tort system. The same accusation. We reviewed that then, and we've done it. You know, it seems like about every 8 or 9 years, it always comes up, and we've never found that to be the case. If the issue is, are there rare instances where a physician might have multiple suits against them, say a radiologist, it can happen. But it's exceedingly rare, incredibly rare, to have happen. I'm only aware of one instance in the last 25 years, and the physician was found to not be at fault in that case. In regard to other activities, we, of course, also do loss prevention activities as well. We also have and have had for years a program where physicians who are identified whose skills or personalities or other issues might be at issue, we have a program that deals with those physicians in a positive way to make sure that their skills are at appropriate levels or a variety of other things. The BME also has great authority to also address physicians of that type. And I guess the final thing I would say is that we did a number of things last session that maybe, or we supported a lot of things last session. The legislature voted on them that I think were very positive. As you know, you've mentioned this before, we were the requesters for the statement of regret or remorse, or some people call it the apology bill. I think that was very positive. I think it was very positive for us to do it. And in the patient safety legislation, we were well aware that there was language that says that if there is a untoward result with the patient, that the patient or family would be notified of that, which I think is a positive thing as well. And we've done a number of things legislatively, I think, that are very progressive, including the patient safety legislation, that are key. One thing that we did not succeed in, and again, it's Oregon is a unique state. I believe Dr. Bernardo mentioned it. We're only one of two other, one other state where we still do trial by ambush, and we don't disclose who the expert witness is. That legislation passed the House in relatively close vote, and we had to make a choice on the Senate side on another bill, of which bill we might have a chance of being considered in the Senate, and it ultimately passed. But this was, but that bill, the disclosure of expert witnesses, was not it. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't think that's really the right way for the system to operate, which is easy for me to say because I'm not an attorney. But you know, hopefully we'll be we're doing more creative things on the patient safety side as an association that are going to be at the office level. We've just recently, and I think the Board of Medical Examiners is going to adopt standards for anesthesia services at the ambulatory office level on conscious sedation, which I think is very, very positive, very good for patient safety. All of these things have been going on in a lot of instances for years, and most often the public is just not aware of it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Crew, I've got actually a couple of questions for you.
If I could just follow up on one thing that I forgot to say on the dash sixes, which is the Medical Excess Liability Fund, and that is it does exclude cases involving either gross negligence or intentional conduct by a physician. There would be no intention of limiting those claims. There would still be wide open litigation on those. Other than that.
Okay. Two questions for you. Based on your review of the main model, and I guess the main model particularly, I assume there's some type of jury instruction that is given regarding the panel's finding as to what they the jury can or can't do with that information.
Senator, I believe there is. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you, but I recall, I believe there is. We provided for that in ours because we were concerned about a constitutional issue and wanted to keep that to a very minimum as to what a jury is told.
All right. The last question, again, regarding the main cases. When Dr. Moorhead was here, he was talking about two cases that went forward to trial. I took that to mean that those were decisions that were adverse at the panel and then they proceeded, because I have to assume that there's been more than two cases in Maine that have actually gone forward after there's been a panel ruling.
I'm Mr. Gallant is sponsoring to answer that, so let's let him answer, because I think he's actually more familiar with the Maine statistics than I am.
No, probably not. Mr. Chairman, Scott Gallant for the record. What Dr. Moorhead was alluding to was that the information we have is that two cases where the recommendation of the panel was for the plaintiff, the other was for the defendant, a jury overturned their decision and found for the party, the other party, is what he was saying.
Mr. Chairman, I do have some information on that. From 1987 through 2002, Maine produced a study from the panel, results of their panel. They took 21 cases of unanimous panel verdicts to a jury. Of those 21 trials, two were won by plaintiff. You're talking about 19 by the defense. And I'd also point out, in Maine's model, only unanimous decisions are admissible. If it's a mixed decision, it is not admissible.
And it was one of the things that I spoke with the Maine Society, Medical Society, about, and their attorney. And they said if they were going to go back and fix anything, that's what they would fix, is that it should not be unanimous, it should be majority. And that's the reason why we chose the majority.
Senator Bates, did you want to comment?
You know, you've answered a lot of the questions. I had a lot of discussions with plaintiff and defense attorneys in Maine on the same issues, probably the same conversations as well as their major insurer. They're basically the same information. Probably the only thing that would be different about that is that the judge now has a very prescribed way of describing to the jury what the finding of the panel was. Prior to a few years ago, it was very open. A lot of the information that the panel looked at was presented to the jury by both sides. Now the judge very carefully instructs the jury exactly what that panel's finding were and what they can do with it as far as considering what their verdict's going to be. So it's much more limited than it was before. And since that has occurred, it appears that they've had the two cases that have been reversed. In other words, when I say reversal, prior to that time, it was whatever the panel had decided, pretty well the jury decided to. But since that change, according to what the attorneys I talked to, they've had at least two cases where the panel said one thing and the jury went the other direction. So it's changed a little bit there, but not a lot.
Okay. R-6 amendments set out verbatim what the court may tell the jury, and it's very limited. But before the jury is even told what the outcome was, the jury's told that they are free to accept or reject that panel finding. And then all they're told is that the panel found for the defendant, for the plaintiff, or for the defendant. There is no other discussion. It's not permitted.
Okay, thank you very much. If there's not any other questions, I'm going to call our next panel up. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mick Alexander. And while he's coming up, is there anyone else that's here today that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 446? And your name, sir?
Bruce Miller.
And Mr. Miller, just so I know who you are, can you tell me in what relationship you're coming up to give testimony on?
I'm from the Office of the State Court Administrator.
Okay. Why don't you just sit back, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Miller. Mr. Alexander, right ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the chairman, I'm a one-person panel today.
One of many. One of one.
I'd really kind of like to talk about issues that I see in the legislation that haven't really been discussed, and I want to talk a little bit about goals. Incidentally, I obviously was on the group from Senator Bates and Senator Ringo, along with Dr. Moorhead and other doctors, that I thought was very productive, cordial, good discussions. I really wish we could have done more and for a longer period of time. I was also on Governor Kitzhaber's task force that looked into the medical malpractice insurance issues back in, I got to remember the election year, summer of 2002, right before he left office, and we spent about 5 or 6 months on this issue at that point in time. And I want to talk, I'll address whatever I can in the time, but I want to focus on the goals and how you reach those. Now, I'm a trial lawyer. I'm a past president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Obviously, I have my views about tort reform, but I certainly want an insurance system that has stable premiums and affordable premiums for doctors. And I want that not only as a trial lawyer. I want that as a consumer of medical services in the state of Oregon. I want doctors here. I want availability of medical services for me and my family and for every other citizen. But I don't want it to be, unless it's necessary, I don't want that to be at the expense of injured parties. So my goal is to try to find a way, and through legislation, some of which is here before us, and there will be amendments that we'll offer, in which perhaps both those goals could be achieved. I think that would be very socially desirable if we could preserve the rights of injured parties and have a stable and affordable insurance system. In fact, I think that would be a wonderful accomplishment for the state of Oregon. Now, does that just mean I'm here because I want to be a nice guy to doctors and I want to have citizens treated well in Oregon? That's one of the reasons I'm here. Obviously, there's a benefit to the people I represent, and there's a benefit to the lawyers that I are my colleagues, trial lawyers. And that is that when we have these horribly fluctuating insurance rates and we have anecdotal stories, and I was here in 2003 and I listened to the stories and I've listened to the doctors and the testimony about doubling and tripling of premium rates and doctors being charged $150,000 or $200,000 to provide services, and I blanch at that. And I testified in 2003 that I thought it's just terrible and inappropriate for that to happen, but I don't see it as a problem of the tort system, and I saw it as a problem of the insurance system. So the advantage to me and to my interest as a trial lawyer would be that the discussion surrounding tort reform wouldn't be centered on these anecdotal stories of horrendous increases in insurance. And instead, we might be able to elevate the debate and actually discuss issues like reimbursement rates and actually discuss issues about the different compensation among specialties in the medical profession and actually discuss issues about excess claims and the understandable apprehension that creates in doctors' minds without always centering on tort reform. So if the goal is tort reform, and really when I listen to the testimony of the people that have testified before me, it's obvious that the ultimate goal there is to limit the rights of injured people through either limiting their damages or limiting their access to the court by denying them the ability to hire an attorney of their choice. If that's the goal, that's fine, and that's where we disagree. That's not my goal. My goal is to see if we can do something insurance-wise to improve this environment and to improve the situation that exists for doctors in the state of Oregon. I'm not an actuary. I think I used to know how to do some pretty simple math, but I am still struck by the figures whenever I hear testimony about the non-affordability of medical malpractice insurance. And the PLF model is based upon our professional liability fund for lawyers, and it has a number of basic things, but it has a couple of basic components. One is it's a monopoly. It has the advantages. I know that seems counterintuitive at times, the advantages of a monopoly. And the other is that it spreads the risk equally. All the lawyers are charged at the same rates. That has an extremely stable effect on our premiums. We have had probably the best premium market. I mean, I haven't done the survey, but I hear stories from other states about legal malpractice insurance, and it did the same thing that medical malpractice insurance has done. And I remember, and I testified in 2003 after I listened to the CNA actuary who was opposed to this idea and indicated that over the last 10 years, if such an outlandish idea would have actually have been implemented, every doctor in the state of Oregon would have paid $5,000 a year for medical malpractice insurance. And when I heard that testimony, I went, well, yeah, that's the point. And actually, I looked at this environment, and we were provided in the work group, we were provided statistics from the Department of Consumer and Business Services concerning the level of malpractice premiums in the last 5 years, these awful years, between 1999 and 2003, that five-year period. And I wanted to make sure that at least I had this simple math correct, and so I talked to representatives from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I says, direct premiums earned, that's what the doctors are charged per year, that's right. And then I did simple math, because that's the kind I understand, and I took the number of doctors, and we got that statistic as well, and I divided it into those premiums. And for CNA, over 5 years, they averaged about $16.3 million a year. That's from 1999 to 2003. $16.3 million a year for 2,200 doctors, or about $7,400 a year. And for Northwest physicians, they had about an average of about $15.8 million per year for slightly over 2,000 doctors, or a little less than $8,000 per year per doctor. I know that's simple math, but I just cannot extract myself from those figures when I hear about the fact that medical malpractice insurance is unaffordable in the state of Oregon. I just cannot separate myself from those figures, and maybe I'm just stubborn at it. So when we look at a PLF idea, and I talked to the PLF director today, and I encourage you folks to talk to the PLF director, and we talk about the issue of, we call it compression or lack of underwriting. In other words, if not charging everyone equally, at least compressing the difference between what you can charge, the highest charge on a doctor and the lowest charge on a doctor. If it's 2-to-1 or 3-to-1, you still have dramatic stability and decreases in premiums for the highest specialists. And over time, I mean, and I know it would be slowly over time, but if reimbursement rates are based at least in part on medical malpractice premiums, then the reimbursement rates have got to make some sort of adjustment so you don't have a terrible inequity between the lower compensated physicians and the higher compensated physicians. But if you're talking about $8,000 or $10,000 a year, and you can do that, and instead you want to limit the rights of injured parties, then my goal is to not limit the rights of injured parties. And if folks disagree with that, that's fine. I mean, I can handle the disagreement. But I think there's a remedy there that's available. And when we talked about this PLF model, we also can have not only the idea of compression of rates, in other words, changing rates, but charging physicians on other than just insurance-driven actuarial factors. In other words, what if rural physicians, because of lots of reasons, because of the need for care in rural areas, because maybe of different reimbursement rates or different income, needed a break on medical malpractice insurance premiums? A professional liability fund for doctors run through a board setup could consider that and say, you know what? Maybe the obstetricians in Roseburg ought to be charged different from the obstetricians in Portland. And maybe the obstetricians in Bend ought to be charged different from the obstetricians in both those states for factors that don't necessarily, that an accountant doesn't necessarily determine, that has some social value in it. And I heard, and I've heard a lot of testimony by doctors about poor Medicare reimbursement, about hardly being able to handle people on the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid people. I mean, if it was me and I'm on this board setting rates, I'm going to say, I'm going to give those folks a break. And I'm going to do it for one reason. Because they're doing something that's important socially. And they're giving up income as a result.
Ask now.
Yes, I do.
Go right ahead.
Are you suggesting, sir, that these malpractice or liability insurance rates should be set on social values rather than actuarial tables?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'm saying that, in my opinion, I think that should be a consideration, not the whole consideration, but I'm saying it would be something that could go into the mix. Now it doesn't go into the mix. It's just a matter of risk assessment. And I'm not saying that you just say you give someone a free ride. You know, we're doing that now, Senator. We are subsidizing rural physicians through the funds that were obtained during the last legislative session. And so right now, except for it's coming through the taxpayers, we're doing exactly that. We're saying that for social purposes, we're going to give somebody a break, only this time we're going to do it through a subsidy as opposed to a reduction, which would result, in essence, in a subsidy by the rest of the physicians. Mm-hmm. So, sure. Do I think it? I think it should be a factor. Yes, I do.
Go right ahead.
I think you mentioned earlier that there's injured parties. I think in this situation there are three classes of injured parties. One of those are those injured patients. The second are the patients who are unable to access or afford medical care any longer. In the rural areas, that's becoming more and more of a problem as our OBGYN and specialists are unable to maintain their practices due to malpractice insurance costs or liability costs. They're leaving, and we simply don't have that ability any longer to access at any cost because the service is no longer there. And the third party that's injured is the physician themselves. And I've got a great example of that. There's an OBGYN practitioner in my district who, by all evaluations, is one of the best of the best. After standing up for tort reform, she was sued 3 times in 6 months and never been sued before in her life. None of those cases have any merit, but this woman can no longer get medical malpractice insurance at any price. So I would say she is also a victim.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, I certainly agree that there's multiple victims that occur. I think a doctor or any professional or any person who becomes a defendant in a lawsuit, that's tough. I mean, that's a hard road. And in some of the in catastrophic injuries, it's very difficult. I think, obviously, there are people that you may have heard or may see that are the true physical victims of injury that are tragic cases. And as far as access, that's what I'm trying to address. Can we create, through something original, can we create an insurance climate that is going, can't necessarily solve the problems with those other victims, but at least it can solve that problem that you identified and that I certainly recognize. If doctors are leaving the state and insurance is one reason, can we make the insurance climate, that environment, more favorable through a risk-spreading device that we don't have to go to other states. We can go right here in Oregon and see that it works, and it has worked for 30 years.
All right. Well, I'd like to complete the testimony so we can have it all, because what we're going to do is we've got at least one more witness instead of breaking it up, if we could do that.
I'll wait.
Senator Beyer, can you wait, or do you have a question?
Well, I'd like to correct something. You said that there is a social insurance program now, and it's funded by the taxpayers. I'd just like to correct you. It's not funded by the taxpayers. It's funded by the employers in the state of Oregon. It was a rate on SAFE dollars, but SAFE gets tax credit back, but the employers pay into it. So it's not taxpayer-funded, it's employer-funded.
I consider them taxpayers, too. But I didn't know about the details of it, Senator, as far as whether it's broadly spread. I know it came out of SAFE, but I don't know exactly how. I know it's a credit, but I don't know exactly how that works.
Mr. Alexander, do you have other testimony you'd like to give us?
Get back on. The Department of Consumer and Business Services also put together figures about creating this fund, and they did it under different assumptions, and I'm not going to go into all of those assumptions, but they should be in materials that are available to you or that will be available when Ms. Stressinger has an opportunity to testify. But again, if we're talking about the overall cost, the estimates that I saw in the letter of March of 2005 from DCBS had a cost of between $84 million and $106 million based on 7,000 doctors participating, which would be a broader group than CNA and Northwest Physicians, and that came out to about $12,000 to $15,000 per doctor. I have figures about this idea of compression, 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 compression. I won't go through the figures. I could supply them. They were done in 2003, and you can really see the ameliorating effect that it has just by some simple compression. And again, I'm still struck by enormous increases that are sort of off the map if you look at the average premium figures that were submitted to us from CNA and Northwest Physicians. And they have a range like for neurosurgeons of $63,000 to $72,000, and yet people come in and they say they're paying $100,000 or $200,000, maybe differences in coverage. But I've looked at these figures for years and years and years. I just don't see how it's an affordability issue. If the goal is to make insurance affordable, I think we should look at an insurance remedy and not at remedies that always focus on the rights of injured parties. I think some of the proposals of having the commercial insurance carriers fund the underlying $500,000 and then have a liability fund above that, I disagree with Mr. Crewe, obviously, about the constitutionality of some of his provisions in the dash six or four, I can't remember which they are. But also I think that concept turns the whole advantages of the PLF on its head. Because if the commercial market comes in and sets the rates on $500,000 of coverage, that's where most of the claims are paid. in some of the other material from the from DCBS, about 75% of all premium dollar covers the first $400,000 in risk, and about 25% of premium dollar then covers all of the rest of the risk. So you're talking about creating a market where the bulk of the premium is still going to be subject to all the market forces with no compression, without any of the adjustments that you'd be able to make with a PLF, and then you're going to set the excess up through a PLF sort of process that are going to have to has to handle the more volatile claims. And, of course, the underlying insurers on any big claims are just going to lateral the ball to this excess claim that has been funded and may have some opportunity for some compression, perhaps. And incidentally, in that legislation, all that legislation, they do talk about considering setting premiums and categories based upon Medicare and Medicaid patients and rural locale in terms of the considerations that come to play. So I will submit some amendments, I think, just to kind of tweak on the PLF model. I really think if you want a good PLF model, you're going to have minimum $1 million limits and let the doctors get the excess, and you're going to have some requirement for compression, and you're going to level out the rates, and you're going to have a stable insurance market. And if you have a stable insurance market, then we can come in other legislative sessions and we can talk about some of these other, I think, certainly as complex and more serious problems that are facing the medical community in this state.
Senator Wissett first, let him go ahead and continue, then Senator Bates.
I would just more of a comment. It seems to me that what you want to do here is to address a symptom of the disease, not the cause of the disease. And I don't think that the insurance rates are the cause of the disease. I think the lack of a liability cap is the cause of the disease.
Senator Bates.
Mick, thanks for coming in again today. I know you put a lot of time into the work group. I'm sorry we couldn't reach a consensus there, but I think we had a good work group that got some good work done and got a lot of things on the table for us, and I appreciate your efforts again. I think you illustrate that people who, believe it or not, have goodwill can get together and not agree on everything. And I really applaud you for coming in, and you were one of the voices of reason there, along with the physicians that were present, and I appreciate the efforts you took.
Well, I very much appreciate your comments, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate. And I do think it was a very helpful demonstration of just being able to talk about things in a reasonable and rational manner. And as I think I indicated to you in the group, and I certainly acknowledge publicly, the process that then you have to go through is a lot more difficult than what we had to do in that group.
Thank you, Mick. Mr. Chair, the one thing I would like to do is, and I assume this is going to come later in testimony or in discussion here, is to look at those rates and hear from the insurance industry why they disagree with what Mick has told us about the amount of money flowing into the insurance companies and why that is still not the level of the playing field, so to speak. So I'd like to hear the other side of the argument, too. Not today, obviously, right, but at a later time.
What we're going to do is Mr. Miller is going to come in and testify if there's someone else that wanted to give testimony today. My plan as chair is to, and Mr. Alexander, I understand that you have some amendments you're working on. I'd like to get those as quick as possible because I want to make sure everyone on the committee has access to them, and I want to make sure the OMA and others that have given testimony will have access to them as well. The goal of the chair is that we will be meeting a week from today. We will at that point be going through some of the amendments that we have or the amendments that are before us to get some explanation as to what those are and how they work. I expect we'll have DCBS back. That will give us some information that they were ready to give today, but we just didn't have the time to take them in before they needed to leave. I will make one comment, and if anyone wants to make a comment to my comment, I'll be glad to have that brought on the record. My understanding is that caps in this state, Senator Wissett, did not occur until 1988, and it went for a period until 1994, 95, 99, 99. But the point being 94. Is that we didn't have caps prior to
1988.
Okay. We did not have caps prior to 1988 when the 87 session actually took place. So to me, again, I think there's other things. Of course, I think I come, except for maybe Senator Bates, with a little bit more information and knowledge of other members. Senator Beyer, maybe being on judiciary last time, if I'm not mistaken, were you on the Senate judiciary?
No, it was not last session.
I know that on the House side we had a lot of this, and so I've gotten a lot more information than I think a lot of the members have had opportunity, plus that interim task group that I had an opportunity to sit on. So there seems to be multiple factors, not just one individual thing, that are causing these cost drivers when you look at not only our state but around the country. So, okay. Senator Beyer.
I guess a comment or a response to your comment would be that, as we heard from the doctors and we've heard at other times, we were in crisis until 88. We got caps. We went out of crisis from a period of 88 through 99, and we lost our caps, and now we're back in crisis. So what you say is true, but it's the driver.
Actually, there's three different economic cycles that they show to us where they have had different things, and there's different parts to that. I think we'll hear a little bit more of this next week regarding those parts. And the goal is that we're going to try to do some review and then blend. And then we'll always will have those that will differ in opinion as to exactly what those significant drivers or costs are. But I agree there are different factors, but I will still say that there is absolutely not one individual factor, because if it's true, you'd have all in other states where they've had caps in place for a significant period of time, not just the ones that have just taken it on, that would be not in crisis as they found themselves to be in. Mr. Alexander, thank you for your time. Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Assistant Staff Counsel with the Office of the State Court Administrator. I'm not here today to discuss the important policy issues in front of you, but I did want to raise a couple of procedural notions that that I have regarding the main system, the main panel system. One thing I'd like to point out about that system is that's run through their superior court, which is their trial court level, not through their Supreme Court. It's run by the Chief Justice of their Superior Court, so it's easy to confuse that with our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They have, I believe, around 36 trial judges in Maine. We have 27 judicial districts in Oregon with many, many more trial judges. So my point is our system is a little bit larger than theirs. So as we look to move their system into ours, if that's the committee's wish, then I think we need to consider the impact as we move from a smaller system to a larger system. And the issues that I haven't seen the Dash 4 amendments, but I have seen another concept in the building that addresses the main system or implements the main system here. And in that concept, I saw several significant differences from the main system. It was more involved, more complex, and would have more impact on the judicial department. Specifically, the department would have to forecast costs, would have to come up with assessments on the parties who are going to fund the program. The Chief Justice would have to formulate rules that would apply to how the panels conduct their business. There would be compensation issues of the panel members. Another issue that came to mind involved the duty given to the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court to assemble a list of qualified individuals. I think one thing that we ought to think about when we look at that, it's probably not an onerous duty for the Chief Justice to assemble qualified attorneys, for him to assemble qualified medical personnel to also sit on those panels. May be a bigger task for him, especially if you consider the problem of delegation of powers. I think it would be difficult for him to simply accept a list from another group saying this is a qualified list. And I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's something that we need to think about how that would be accomplished. My point was simply to point out some of the differences between what I've seen in the concept and the main model as it exists, as well as some of the impacts that we've picked out that would apply to the court system, and we're happy to help develop a process that will try to meet everyone's needs. Thank you.
Thank you. One question. I know that y'all have just taken a snapshot at this. Have you looked at any fiscal as to what you think might be involved based on just what you've looked at today?
I haven't seen today's amendments, so I can't comment on that. We had begun to gather information on the main model, but we haven't gone anywhere near fiscal on it. In my mind, some of the areas that would really raise some significant fiscal are the forecasting, the assessments, the collecting money to fund the program. I think there will be fairly significant startup costs on establishing rules, especially if there's a tight time frame, developing lists of panelists and things of that nature. But as far as what kind of money we're talking about, we're nowhere near determining that yet. And, of course, we'd need to look at the Dash 4.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Miller? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I don't know if Mr. Miller is the right person or someone else, but we have maybe something in this state. They don't have a Maine, which is a hearings officer panel. And I wonder if that group could be used to facilitate something like this.
Mm-hmm. Good suggestion. Any other questions? And is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today before we close the public hearing? And not hearing or seeing running up to the top, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 446, and we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you very much.